witnessed to describe pejoratively Ho's Vietnam long before the American Army and press corps globalized it in English. Post-1945 Vietnamese history cannot be reduced simply to war. However, the savage, sustained violence the Indochinese conflict unleashed directly influenced Vietnamese mentalities, society, and the states emerging from it. The French and the very transnational army that did most of the fighting for them did not emerge unscathed either. Veterans from Senegal and Algeria carried things with them long after this war ended. They also left behind some 200,000 children who struggled tragically to find their place in Vietnamese societies that wanted to forget them as much as the French shunned children born of Franco-German unions during the Second World War. The Democratic Republic of Vietnam, 1945-50, a colonial graft? So what was this state that opposed the French, other Vietnamese states, and then the Americans so fiercely? For all its nationalist rhetoric, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam was in many ways a colonial creation at the outset. Upon taking power, nationalists did everything in their power to make the colonial state theirs before the colonizers could return. This was hardly surprising. Nationalists across the Afro-Asian world did much the same. In 1945-6, however, Republican Chinese troops of occupation, not communist ones, also contributed to the success of nationalist state building by preventing the French from returning immediately to areas above the 16th parallel and by refusing to overthrow the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. Pragmatism once again trumped ideology in modern Vietnam, this time between Chinese non-communists and Vietnamese communists. Many colonially trained Vietnamese bureaucrats stayed on in their jobs in 1945-6, whether they were moved by nationalism, indecision, or simply driven by the need to put food on the table. A veteran later recalled how his father, a French-trained railway attendant, continued working under the Democratic Republic of Vietnam as if nothing that revolutionary had occurred. He worked for the revolution, still as a civil servant. He did not work for the sake of ideology, but just out of the diligent, conscientious devotion of a civil servant. He just continued to follow his profession and to do his job. Many, of course, supported the new national government on patriotic grounds. Literate young people at ease in Quoc Ngu found a new source of upward mobility and careers as the national government turned to them to fill new and vacant jobs. Many found employment in newly created mass organizations run by the Viet Minh. DRV state building was always weaker in the South, however, where the French returned immediately, and they and their Vietnamese allies were always stronger there. Nowhere was the interface between the colonial and the national more evident than in the pages of the Journal Officiel de l'Indochine, as it imperceptibly became the Cong Bao Dang Quoc, Vietnam, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's government bulletin. Past issues of the Cong Bao provided a day-by-day, decree-after-decree account of how the young Vietnamese Republic assumed operation of the colonial state's people, services, offices, and materials as it went about transforming them in national ways. Decrees instructed civil servants to remain in their jobs. Government authorities resumed trade, reopened forms of transport, and continued the telephone, telegraph, and postal services. Rice finally circulated to help alleviate the recent famine. Decrees authorized the requisition of the Pasteur Institutes, the École Française d'Extrême-Orient, hospitals, colonial primary and secondary schools, as well as the Indochinese University. High on the list, too, were colonial printing presses, newspapers, radios, paper, and typewriters essential to the bureaucratic paper flow. Other edicts established the national flag, a yellow star plastered against a red background, and anthem while colonial street names changed to national ones. In a bid to shore up popular support, the government did away with several colonial taxes, including the much-resented head tax, but maintained others essential to the financial well-being of Vietnam. The Democratic Republic of Vietnam even relied on the colonial police infrastructure and lower-level staff to help in building, consolidating, and protecting its own security and intelligence services. But all was not a colonial graft. Territorially, nationalists did not announce a Republic of Indochina. They could have. The Javanese, after all, had become Indonesian. In mid-1945, the national idea of Vietnam prevailed, not least of all because Lao and Khmer elites wanted nothing to do with Indochina, which was, for them, a Vietnamese as much as a French colonial structure. The majority of Vietnamese nationalists wanted Vietnam and its unification. Gone were the colonial terms for Tonkin, Annam, and Cochin China. In their place appeared the officially sanctioned nationalist terms, Bac Bo, Trung Bo, and Nam Bo. A good nationalist said Vietnamese in 1945, not Annamese. New history books celebrating Vietnam's heroic national past and timeless patriotic resistance poured off the presses, praising the heroic Trung sisters and ancient Vietnamese resistance to foreign domination. School children began singing patriotic songs while young scouts saluted Ho Chi Minh. That said, the seemingly national space was not necessarily the same one that had existed before the French arrived. In establishing colonial frontiers by force in the late 19th century, the colonizers accorded large swaths of land and people to Cochin China, Annam, and Tonkin at the expense of others. Although Vietnamese nationalists vehemently contested the division of Vietnam into three parts, they rarely disputed the colonially established outside edges of the country, including the maritime ones in the South Seas and the Gulf of Thailand. A modern nation-state required a homogeneous citizenship for those who belonged to it. Whereas the French had created a hodgepodge of legal categories for their colonial subjects, the new republic established an inclusive definition of citizenship, transforming almost all of those residing within its territory into Vietnamese nationals, Dan Cong Viet Nam. Significantly, this legislation also transformed national minorities, Dan Toc Thieu So, into citizens. In 1946, the Ministry of the Interior required all Vietnamese who were 18 and over to carry citizenship cards. Similar cards existed for mass organizations such as the Viet Minh and the Indochinese Communist Party. In theory, identification papers provided decision-makers with a better knowledge of their populations. They allowed for the more efficient allocation of resources, the recruitment of manpower and soldiers, and the organization of the census needed to prepare a budget and set taxes. And, of course, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam used such cards to incorporate parts of the population into its political realm. However, this bureaucratic modernity was not a simple colonial carryover from the French. 20th-century Vietnamese politicians drew upon pre-existing Sino-Vietnamese models of administration in building the post-colonial state. Village councils continued to operate as they had under the French or even the Nguyen. Like their Chinese counterparts, Vietnamese communists also relied on a united front to help them control and mobilize people. Ho Chi Minh was the driving force behind the creation of the Viet Minh in 1941. Through it, the communists took power in August 1945 and created the DRV state. They intentionally kept the Viet Minh alive as a political party and simultaneously transformed it into a mass nationalist organization. The communists used it to incorporate, control, and mobilize as many parts of Vietnamese society as possible, with the triple goal of running a state, a war, and eventually a communist revolution. Though small in numbers at the outset, dedicated party militants relied on young, patriotic, but mainly non-communist volunteers to organize an impressive network of national salvation associations, federations, and unions based on religious affiliation, Catholics, Buddhists, Cao Dai followers, gender and age, women's and youth federations, ethnicity, the overseas Chinese and Khmer, and professional status, workers, civil servants, artists, and peasants. Anti-colonialism and national independence guided them. Friends, schoolmates, sweethearts, and family connections did more to build up these organizations in the late 1940s than the ability to cite the Marxist-Leninist canon, while French brutality increased membership better than any single propaganda drive or pamphlet the communists could concoct. Unlike the Front de Libération Nationale, Front for National Liberation, that would fight the French over Algeria, the communists ran the Viet Minh Nationalist Front, and it mattered. The problem was that many Vietnamese intellectuals and bourgeois nationalists avoided the Viet Minh precisely because of its communist core. This, in turn, undermined the Indochinese Communist Party's ability to bring people into its fold. Like those repelled by the French colonial hold over Cochin China in the south, hundreds of highly trained and badly needed non-communist patriots climbed on the fence in the north because of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's communist hue. Of course, French colonial and Vietnamese anti-communist propagandists were only too happy to keep them there by transforming the Viet Minh into a synonym for the communists. The Chinese Republic's occupation allowed the opposition to publish newspapers, organize political parties, and speak in public against the communists, the Viet Minh, and even Ho Chi Minh. The need to widen the National Front became critical for the Indochinese Communist Party in mid-1946 with the departure of the Chinese Army and the subsequent outbreak of civil war above the 16th parallel. In May 1946, as the communists mobilized the army and the police to destroy the anti-communist opposition parties, the government, pushed by the Indochinese Communist Party, created a new national front called the Association of United Vietnamese People, the Hoi Lien Hiep Quoc Dan Viet Nam, or the Lien Viet for short. Ho was honorary president of this super-national front, which regrouped all patriotic individuals who had not yet joined the Viet Minh within it. From this point, the Viet Minh existed in an even more confusing relationship with the Lien Viet until the latter formally absorbed it in 1951. Despite their ideological differences, Vietnamese nationalists of all political colors agreed on one thing: the importance of running a modern independent state complete with a presidency, cabinet, ministers, and a parliament. The Japanese-backed government, led by Tran Trong Kim, had already demonstrated this. Days after delivering the Declaration of Independence on the 2nd of September, Ho Chi Minh signed universal suffrage into law and called for national elections to form a constituent assembly, an official government, and for the purpose of the elaboration of Vietnam's first constitution. Lively debates characterized the organization of the first national elections in January 1946. This experiment in post-colonial democracy gave birth to the country's first national assembly in March. The chairman of the parliament was none other than the man the French had so badly humiliated through their failure to allow for fuller colonial democracy after 1918, Hoang Thuc Khang. The DRV leadership also wanted a parliament in order to demonstrate to liberal-minded Vietnamese and to the colonialists that they were on the side of modern republicanism. While there is no denying the authenticity of the debates surrounding the creation of Vietnam's first constitution and national assembly, this early experiment in multi-party politics was largely forced on the communists due to their own weakness, the Chinese nationalist presence, and the need to show the French and the world that they were more nationalist and democratic than communist and dictatorial. Chinese protection allowed the opposition parties to publish newspapers, assemble publicly, and criticize the communists. Under Chinese pressure, Ho postponed the elections until January 1946 in order to give the opposition more time to prepare for it. He also accepted the hardly democratic request of receiving in advance 70 seats in the future assembly for the Vietnamese Nationalist Party and the Vietnamese Revolutionary Alliance, including the reservation of the vice presidency for Nguyen Hai Tan, who was of the Revolutionary Alliance, and three other important ministerial positions for the Nationalists. That these non-communist parties backed by the Chinese pushed for this hardly made them any more democratically inclined than their adversaries. This first flawed experiment in multi-party politics only lasted above the 16th parallel until late June 1946. When the Chinese army pulled out, the communists attacked those in the Vietnamese opposition parties, the Vietnamese Nationalist Party, Vietnamese Revolutionary Alliance, and Dai Viet, with the police and the army, supported in part by the French army. By September 1946, what was left of the opposition parties fled to southern China, languished in Democratic Republic of Vietnam prison camps, went into hiding, or crossed over to the French. The communist-run security services closed independent opposition newspapers, confiscated their presses, and reformed the remaining Vietnamese non-communist nationalist parties, the Vietnamese Nationalist Party and the Revolutionary Alliance, and integrated them into the Lien Viet as the communist-commanded DRV now moved one step closer to becoming a single-party state. When the National Assembly met for the second time on the 28th of October, 1946, of the total number of 444 deputies, only 291 were present. Distances were long. War was on in the South. Of this number, the opposition parties counted only 37 delegates. Continued communist-directed operations and violence against their political competitors were such that on the 8th of November, the day the General Assembly voted for the Constitution, only two members of the opposition were present out of the total number of 240 delegates there. Liberal intellectuals and politicians in the DRV Parliament accepted this in order to maintain national unity, all the while hoping in secret that Vietnamese communists would respect the Constitution, guaranteeing parliamentary democracy. They would be disappointed, like their counterparts who had allied with the French colonialists. Indeed, the French leaders may have ridiculed the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's elections in late 1946, but if they did so, they had conveniently forgotten that in mid-1946, they themselves had named the new leaders of the Cochin Chinese Republic, censored the press, and had been careful to avoid any kind of vote on national unification. Democracy would never come easily to Vietnam, neither under the French nor their communist adversaries. Administratively, the DRV government maintained the three regions into which Minh Mang had divided the country in the 1830s. Each region, north, south, and center, was divided into smaller internal zones in early 1948, each of which in turn administered its provinces, districts, and villages. The government exercised power through the creation of popular committees, then via administrative committees, which ultimately became administrative and resistance committees, Oi Bang Keng, Cheng Hang Chin, with the outbreak of full-scale war. This four-tiered hierarchy, zones, provinces, districts, and villages, constituted the administrative backbone through which the Democratic Republic of Vietnam operated until 1954. The 12 ministries making up the central government transmitted instructions downward to their corresponding offices present at each level of the administrative chain, offices for the interior, the economy, justice, education, etc. Working via this structure, bureaucrats collected taxes, dispensed justice, maintained order, and schooled children. The Viet Minh and Lien Viet also operated parallel offices located within the administrative and resistance committees. State administration and mass mobilization were designed to work in tandem. While the Viet Minh was the largest political party and nationalist front in late 1945, the communists did not yet rule a single-party state. For one thing, the Indochinese Communist Party was numerically weak, with only 5,000 members in September 1945. Communists maneuvered adroitly in the background, directed the police and the army, and did their best to control the real positions of power in the government and mass organizations. Secondly, in 1945-6, the communists were on the defensive with the arrival of Chinese Republican troops and the Vietnamese opposition parties they protected. Fearful of a Chinese-backed coup, the ICP dissolved itself in November 1945 and accepted a coalition government. Of course, the Indochinese Communist Party never sacrificed itself and operated secretly. But a party that chooses to dissolve itself, even on paper, is not in a position to be totalitarian. What worried them most as they scrambled to survive the French onslaught of 1947 and get the Democratic Republic of Vietnam up and running in the countryside was the painful realization of just how dangerously weak the communist hold over the state and the population was at ground level. The ICP's secret parallel administrative hierarchy rarely reached below the provincial level before 1950. Even though mass membership drives increased the number of communists to 500,000 by this date, the overwhelming majority was poorly trained, unreliable, opportunistic, and often illiterate. Indeed, the transformation of the Indochinese Communist Party into the Vietnamese Workers' Party in 1951 was designed in part to give the communist leadership an excuse to purge its bad elements, streamline its size, and improve quality control. Vietnamese communists led by Ho Chi Minh and Thuong Chinh were dedicated communists. They dreamed of Lenin's democratic centralism, and they made plans for communizing Vietnam. But communism, like Confucianism before it, did not appear magically everywhere in Vietnam, nor did everyone embrace it. Indeed, the last thing the party wanted to do as it headed for the hills in 1947 was to alienate non-communist social groups whom it directly needed to run ministries, the army, schools, and hospitals. This was even more important as the French and non-communist Vietnamese nationalists started to build alternative Vietnams of an anti-communist kind. Chapter 9. Internationalized States of War. The former emperor of Annam knew they would come. They always did. The fact that he had abdicated in 1945, that he had begged de Gaulle not to reconquer Vietnam by force, and that he remained an advisor to Ho Chi Minh would not stop them. When the French came to court Bao Dai once again, this time to entreat him to be the titular head of state of their future associated state of Vietnam, Bao Dai understood the Indochina civil servants very well. He knew their mindset and the colonial ideology driving them. Bao Dai even shared with them the same colonial godfathers, Albert Sorot and Pierre Pasquier. We do not know what the former emperor thought of Nguyen Van Thin's tragic death in 1946, but we can be sure that whatever Bao Dai's flaws, and they were many, naivety was not among them. The Indochina administrators wanted from him the very things for which Sorot had fashioned Bao Dai as a child after the First World War, as a colonial weapon to fight anti-colonialists, the living symbol of Franco-Vietnamese collaboration, a ruler through whom the French could rally the peasant masses, and an administrative instrument through which to rule indirectly. This was not to be the first Bao Dai solution, it was the fourth. But three things distinguished this latest one. The French now agreed to extend the monarchy to all of Vietnam, not just central Annam. The Vietnamese head of state would work in tandem with monarchs in Laos and Cambodia. And the French would align all three states with the West in order to use the Cold War to preserve their colonial presence in Indochina. An associated state of Vietnam as a Western-backed Indochinese protectorate? Léon Pignon was the mastermind of colonial monarchy after the Second World War. As early as July 1946, he had castigated French military commanders for joining forces with the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's leaders to run the non-communist nationalists out of Vietnam, along with the withdrawing Chinese. Whatever the nationalists' anti-French vitriol in public, the political advisor to the High Commissioner said, it was just posturing. The French could and should use the nationalist opposition in order to combat the DRV. With characteristic Machiavellianism, Pignon put the strategic goal to his boss in one simple sentence. The opposition to the present government of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam must serve the permanent interests of France in this country. Divide and rule was once again at the core of French colonial policy. To this end, he suggested that his longtime collaborator, Jean Cousseau, travel to Hong Kong to contact Bao Dai. The colonial administrators were certain they could win over the former emperor once again. In January 1947, Thierry d'Argenlou advised his government to pursue the restoration of the traditional monarchical institution. He immediately dispatched Cousseau and others to contact Bao Dai and initiate informal talks with others. The outbreak of war between the French and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and the changing international situation convinced a wide range of non-communist nationalists that they too could play the Bao Dai card against both the French and the DRV. In February 1947, Nguyen Thuong Tham and Nguyen Hai Tan created the All-Country National Union Front, Matrang Quoc Gia Dong Nat Thuong Quoc, and stepped up their contacts with Bao Dai. They renewed requests for Republican Chinese assistance, hoping that the resumption of the long civil war between Chinese communists and nationalists would finally end the United Front strategy that had hurt Vietnamese non-communists so badly since the 1930s. In March, the All-Country National Union Front formally terminated its collaboration with the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and laid out its plans to create a non-communist republic or a constitutional monarchy. The All-Country National Union Front also turned to the new global power emerging from World War, the United States. Nationalists betted that the Americans would help them, as they were helping China's Chiang Kai-shek against the Communist Party's Mao Zedong, and that they would force the French to decolonize, as the Americans had done in the Philippines in July 1946. Ideologically, anti-communism would unify them all. In March 1947, Truman announced his doctrine of containment and began transforming Japan into America's would-be pillar of Asian containment. We now know the Americans would disappoint, but no one could know this then. A third way thus seemed possible in 1947. Patriots inside Vietnam like Tran Trong Kim and Ngo Dinh Diem traveled back and forth to China to discuss plans with All-Country National Union Front leaders, Bao Dai, and foreign diplomats about what to do next. Vietnamese Catholics also distanced themselves from both the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's Communist Corps and the French colonial hold over the country and joined discussions. Until 1950, the nationalist-minded Bishop Le Hu Thu transformed his diocese in Biu Chu and Phat Diem into an autonomous and armed religious microstate in the lower Red River Delta, complete with its own administration, tax regime, and troops. The idea that Vietnamese Catholics rushed to help the French re-establish colonial rule is wrong. The only religious groups Pignon could turn provisionally against the DRV in early 1947 were in the south, among the Cao Dai and the Hoa Hao, and whom the French immediately recruited into their Cochin Chinese state. But Thierry d'Argenlou was so suspicious of Nguyen Van Xuan's nationalism that he replaced the president of the Cochin Chinese Republic with the Hoa Hao seemingly more pliant Li Van Hoc. Non-communists opposed to the DRV increasingly agreed that they would have to stand together behind Bao Dai and rely on a bloc of like-minded supporters in China and in Vietnam. They turned to the ex-emperor, not just because the French insisted on negotiating with him, but also because they believed that Bao Dai represented their best chance for forcing the French to accept Vietnam's independence and unity and winning American support. In March, the All-Country National Union Front formally pledged its support to Bao Dai. For the time being, the former Nguyen Emperor expressed his willingness to step forward for the good of the people, but held his cards close to his chest and left his political options open. He refused to break with the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, talked informally with the French and foreign diplomats, and closely followed international and Indochinese events. Most importantly, he refused to return to his French handlers. He informed them instead that he, like Ho, expected them to honor the accords of the 6th of March 1946, meaning the independence of Vietnam within the French Union and the creation of a unitary Vietnamese state, including Cochin China. Two competing Bao Dai solutions, not one, thus developed after the Second World War. In early 1947, the French coalition government in Paris approved financing for the war in Indochina, but announced that it was willing to implement a ceasefire to achieve a negotiated settlement with all of the Vietnamese, including the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. Upon replacing Thierry d'Argenlois in March, the new socialist high commissioner, Émile Bollaert, dispatched one of the rare liberal-minded Indochina senior government administrators and head of the Colonial Academy, Paul Mousse, to meet with Ho Chi Minh and Bao Dai about finding a solution. While both men informed Mousse that the French had to recognize Vietnamese independence and unity to move forward, each of these statesmen left the door open to negotiations. What changed over the summer was that anti-communists within the All-Country National Union Front objected to Bollaert and his socialist-led government's willingness to negotiate with the DRV, fearful that such negotiations could see the non-communists taking orders again from Ho Chi Minh in a coalition government as in 1945-6. The colonial-minded Mouvement Républicain Populaire, MRP, or the Popular Republican Movement, the French army commanded in Indochina, and the Gaullists regrouping the Rassemblement du Peuple Français, RPF, or the Rally of the French People, agreed. The last thing they wanted to see was Ho return to power peacefully, now that they were on the brink of destroying his state for good. Valui was preparing a large attack over the summer to do precisely that. The ousting of the French communists from the ruling coalition in Paris in May further convinced the Popular Republican Movement leadership that it could engineer the same thing in Indochina by winning over the anti-communists in the person of Bao Dai. Now in the majority, the MRP firmly backed Bao Dai over Ho Chi Minh, demanding nothing short of the latter's capitulation. Unwilling to break with the Popular Republican Movement over this, in a fateful decision they would repeat in Algeria, the socialists towed the harder line within the coalition government in Paris. Government instructions now ruled out concessions on the questions of Vietnam's independence and unity. Bollaert had initially planned to speak favorably of these matters in a major speech scheduled for the 15th of August, the very day the British were to accord independence to India and Pakistan. Instead, on the 10th of September, the High Commissioner invited non-communists to negotiate with the French, intentionally excluded the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, but carefully avoided any talk of independence with any Vietnamese. Although profoundly disappointed by Bollaert's silence on independence, the non-communists had part of what they wanted strategically, the French exclusion of the DRV from negotiations, and that was enough for them to make the next move. A week later, Bao Dai broke formally with the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in his address to the Vietnamese people and announced that he was ready to enter into contact with the French authorities. A few weeks later, Valui launched Operation Lea to capture the DRV leadership and clear the way for direct negotiations with Bao Dai. It failed, but the message was clear. The Popular Republican Movement would not negotiate with the DRV either. The decision by the Third Force, the term that emerged to describe these non-communist nationalists coalescing around Bao Dai, to enter into negotiations with the French in 1947 was a turning point in 20th century Vietnamese political history. It meant that non-communists were ready to risk continued civil war with the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, using French military power to do so, instead of remaining within a national front with the DRV's state and army in order to force the French to decolonize. The communist destruction of the opposition parties in northern Vietnam in mid-1946 hardly facilitated reconciliation. Indeed, the communists in control of the DRV in 1947 had scored a major military victory over their Vietnamese rivals in the previous year. furious with the communist assault on them that year, Greater Vietnam, Dai Viet's supporters, returned to colonial-controlled Vietnam, convinced that the best strategy was to use the French to get rid of their enemies. As a result, Greater Vietnam members began to join the administrative committees in Hanoi and Hue, which the French had established after ousting the DRV there. This was, however, a very risky strategy. Unlike the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, the nationalists lining up behind Bao Dai now entered into negotiations with the French without having an army or a resistance government, neither inside the country nor abroad. The French civil service directed the administration of the parts of Vietnam controlled by the Expeditionary Corps, mainly in the cities and the surrounding deltas, while the DRV tended to the rest. This Third Force Vietnam would thus be a graft onto French Cochin China and the colonial administration committees resuming their work in Annam and Tonkin. Any non-communist national army would be allied with the French. Non-communists like the Dai Viet were working on the assumption that the communists would lose and the French would agree to independence. But what would non-communist nationalists do if the Democratic Republic of Vietnam carried on, or the Popular Republican Movement refused to accord the Vietnamese real independence and power, or both? Such an outcome could transform legitimate non-communist nationalists looking for an alternative to communism and colonialism into colonial puppets. And chronic factionalism among non-communists never helped. Vietnamese communists were many things, but as long as the French refused to negotiate any real independence for Vietnam, they fought on. When Bao Dai arrived in Ha Long Bay in December 1947 to begin talks with the High Commissioner, he discovered to his dismay that the French were just as opposed to the idea of according real independence to him as they had been to Ho. In their formal declaration, Bollaert pronounced the magic word independence, but in a secret protocol initialed by Bao Dai to serve as a basis for negotiations, the French imposed all sorts of legal limitations on it, including the control of any future state's diplomacy, defense, finances, and currency. Bao Dai returned to Hong Kong to discuss the proposals with his allies before resuming talks. Ngo Dinh Diem and others objected to the protocol, demanding that the French respect the March 1946 accords and follow the British lead on India a few months earlier. Constitutional constraints, the French countered, required them to maintain the French Union and thus impose limitations on colonial sovereignty. Diem insisted that an independent national government had to come first, one which non-communists could then build up nationally and turn against the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, with the French and the West alongside. If the British could accord dominion status to India, Diem insisted, so could the French, despite the clause in the 1946 Constitution preventing member states of the French Union from obtaining full sovereignty equal to France. Diem put his case to the French, but the latter were convinced that they could make the Union work and feared that equal independence with the French for the Vietnamese would bring down the entire imperial state they hoped to stitch together via the Union. When Bollaert sent him packing, Diem pulled out of the Third Force Bao Dai solution, convinced that the French were no more serious about recognizing anti-communist nationalists or decolonizing than they had been 20 years earlier. The French creation of special territories for the ethnic minorities under their control in 1948 only reinforced Diem's view. Bao Dai carried on, however, convinced he could use his position in exile to continue to work in collaboration with Vietnamese nationalists inside the country to force the French to decolonize and thereby transform the Cochin Chinese Republic and the administrative committees for Annam and Tonkin into an independent Vietnam on the Third Force's terms. He left the task of testing whether the French would at least allow for the creation of a unitary Vietnam to Nguyen Van Xuan, a fellow socialist Bollaert had named to head up the Cochin Chinese Republic. Greater Vietnam personnel went to work in the administrative committees in Annam and Tonkin. In early 1948, the High Commissioner seemed to soften his position when he accepted the idea of allowing for the creation of a unitary Vietnamese state under Nguyen Van Xuan's leadership. In May, the latter presided over the formation of a provisional central government of Vietnam, combining the Cochin Chinese Republic with the administrative committees for Tonkin and Annam. In June, Bao Dai and Bolet met again in Ha Long Bay. After the usual legal word games about the nature of the French Union and national sovereignty, the High Commissioner recognized the de facto unification of Annam, Tonkin, and Cochin China, but reiterated the strict limitations on independence needed to preserve the French Union. A few days later, the Popular Republican Movement-led government disappointed nationalists profoundly by declaring that the latest Ha Long Bay Accord in no way changed Cochin China's legal status. The Constitution was clear, they said. As it was a colony, only the French National Assembly could approve such a modification. The French thus continued to rule Vietnam at the federal level, and Duan, like Thin before him, was starting to look like a colonial puppet. Bao Dai left for France to negotiate directly with the MRP, but he got no further than Ho had at Fontainebleau in 1946. The talks with Bolet were dead. Failure, however, was not an option. The refusal of the most important non-communists to collaborate with the French undermined their colonial presence and ability to defeat the Democratic Republic of Vietnam politically. Operation Lia had failed militarily. In October 1948, the French redoubled their efforts to build a state around Bao Dai when the Popular Republican Movement named Léon Pignon as the new High Commissioner. From his office in the Palais Norodome in Saigon, France's most important Indochina administrator since Albert Soreau was finally in charge. He immediately mobilized his longtime associates in the colonial administration and forced his full attention on solving the Vietnam problems. Like Soreau, Pignon was also an astute observer of the international scene. He watched carefully as the Berlin crisis, the communist coup in Prague, and the Marshall Plan brought the superpowers to the brink of war in Europe. The polarization of the post-1945 international system in two blocs was obvious to the High Commissioner, as was the growing American commitment to Western Europe, symbolized by the creation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in April 1949. In Asia, Pignon understood that events in China would directly influence the fate of French Indochina. And what he saw in early 1949 did not look good. Mao Zedong was on his way to defeating Chiang Kai-shek and would undoubtedly seal an alliance with the Soviets that would extend the communist bloc to Indochina's northern border. Just as worrisome, decolonization was on the march. Burma, India, and the Philippines were all newly independent. Unimpressed, Pignon watched as the United States, the United Nations, and India pressured the Dutch to let go of Indonesia in 1949. Against the odds, the High Commissioner, his core team, and the government he served remained convinced that the maintenance of French Indochina and French Africa was vital to the French national interest, and that the Bao Dai solution remained the best way to hold on. Rather than follow the Anglo-American example in India and the Philippines, Pignon pushed a three-pronged strategy designed to placate some of the Third Force's demands, but without terminating France's continued colonial presence. First of all, the High Commissioner abandoned the Pentagonal Indochinese Federation. It had existed de facto since late 1945, in favor of creating three separate but associated states of Indochina, Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. This meant that the French would accept Cochin China's unification with Annam and Tonkin, but only on the condition that Bao Dai returned to lead it within the French Union. The French were willing to accord greater independence to all three Indochinese states, provided that each accepted that France would continue to play the role of the fourth member handling relations among them, currency, customs, immigration, etc., and military affairs. This is what quadripartisme, a four-party system meant in the new legal vocabulary introduced by Pignon's team. It was colonial federalism by another name. Secondly, for the High Commissioner, the Associated States of Indochina grand strategy could only work if each state stood behind loyal national monarchs. Like his trusted administrators, Pignon was convinced that the Indochinese peasant majorities remained loyal to their sovereigns, and that the best way to attract and rule them against communists and nationalists was through the intermediaries of these monarchs. The young King Sihanouk had already rejoined the French in 1946, while his Laotian mentor, Sisavang Vong, had never left them. To bolster these kings and their legitimacy, Pignon opened negotiations to rally dissenting nationalist groups in each country. This meant winning over the Khmer and Lao nationalist groups whose leaders had taken refuge in Thailand and contested French rule since the Second World War. From 1945 onward, Lao Isara, Free Lao, nationalists had operated a government in exile from Bangkok. The Khmer Isarak, Free Khmer, movement also created a resistance government in 1948. By their very existence and the quality of their leaders, these governments in exile undermined the legitimacy of the Khmer and Lao monarchies allied with the French. Undeterred, Pignon dispatched emissaries to meet rebel leaders and used the French embassy in Bangkok to rally most of the dissident Khmer and Lao freedom leaders to his grand Indochinese strategy of associated states. But without Bao Dai, there was no royalist solution, and time was running short. As the Chinese Red Army marched across the Yangtze River in early 1949, the French government accepted the unification of Cochin China with Annam and Tonkin. In exchange, Bao Dai had to return to lead the Associated State of Vietnam, ASV, and align himself with King Sisavang Vong, Sihanouk, and the kingmaker himself, Pignon. "We need a hero, too," the High Commissioner sighed to Lucien Baudard one day, "against Ho Chi Minh. We have to have an anti-Ho Chi Minh." That Pignon never thought twice about the poverty of what he was saying speaks volumes of the official colonial mind at the time. The third part of Pignon's strategy focused on the international dimension. Starting in late 1948, the High Commissioner began recasting the fight against the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and for the Associated States as an integral part of the West's wider Cold War struggle against the spread of communism. The idea was to win over Atlantic support for the Indochinese states in the fight against communism and to put pressure on Bao Dai to return to run an independent associated state inside Vietnam or risk being left behind. The American strategic desire to contain communism globally at all costs would trump their reluctance to be seen as backing outdated French colonialists. The French repeated to anyone who would listen on the European desk in the U.S. State Department in Washington and to the American ambassador in Paris that France, Western Europe, and French Indochina, Southeast Asia, were vital to America's global containment strategy. French propaganda changed accordingly. Ho Chi Minh was not a nationalist, but an internationalist communist of the very worst kind, and the French provided all sorts of documents to prove it. The military high command in Indochina chimed in with this, badly in need, as they were, of increased military assistance. The French also targeted the British, who were dealing with the communist uprising in Malaya in 1948, where the British, too, had refused to relinquish their colonial hold. The French connected the British emergency in Malaya to their war in Indochina, both the result of an alleged Sino-Soviet plot to take over Southeast Asia. The British needed little prodding. Keen on holding on to Malaya and Singapore, they joined the Americans in stepping up their support of the most recent Bao Dai solution as the lesser of two evils. Pignon had a much harder time bringing post-colonial India on board, however. Nehru preferred to steer a neutral course between communists and colonialists and the superpowers standing behind them in Asia. Pignon's internationalization of the Indochina problem reached its zenith in January 1950, when Mao and Stalin formally recognized the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. Worried that Sino-Soviet support of the DRV could turn the tide against the French militarily, the High Commissioner repeated to his government in the clearest possible terms why the French had to internationalize the war now. The French would continue the fight to keep Indochina out of the communist grip, but in so doing, the Anglo-Saxons had to provide increased military aid, recognize the Associated States of Indochina diplomatically, and accept a continued French colonial presence there. This was, Pinon concluded, the price which we can accept for this, our military commitment. In reality, his team had already prepared this course of action in collaboration with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. In February 1950, the British and Americans recognized the Associated States of Indochina, followed by the rest of the Atlantic Alliance. The Indians did not, nor did the Indonesians or Burmese. They preferred to remain unaligned. If one scholar has qualified the Algerian nationalist movement's success in turning the international system against the French as a diplomatic revolution, surely Léon Pignon and his popular Republican movement backers achieved a successful diplomatic counter-revolution for the colonial side when Bao Dai signed the Élysée Accords with President Vincent Auriol on the 8th of March, 1949, creating the less than fully independent Associated State of Vietnam. Similar accords followed for Laos and Cambodia. The seemingly insurmountable constitutional obstacles blocking the unification of Cochinchina with Vietnam disappeared with revealing alacrity. On the 22nd of May, the French National Assembly, supported by the hastily convened Cochinchinese Consultative Council, voted in the unification of Cochinchina with the North and the Center. French settlers never had a chance. For the first time, they got a taste of what it was like to be on the wrong side of colonial democracy. Within weeks, Bao Dai was back in Vietnam, supported, indeed pressured, by the Atlantic Alliance, where he formally presided over the creation of the ASV on the 2nd of July, 1949. He became head of a single Vietnamese state and allowed his prime minister to run a government that was no longer provisional. But the French government was still in control. Unlike the Democratic Republic of Vietnam it opposed, or the Republic of Indonesia that obtained its independence that same year from the Dutch, all three associated states remained subject to colonial limitations in the financial, commercial, legal, and military domains. Pinon's three-pronged strategy created what was effectively an internationally backed Indochinese protectorate in the form of three associated monarchs, Bao Dai, Sihanouk, and Sisavang Vong. French colonial federalism remained in effect, as the continued operation of the Indochinese piastre by the Bank of Indochina demonstrated. As Baudard put it, quadripartisme was the extension of French Indochina in an indirect form. From 1948, the communist core of the DRV and the spread of the Cold War across Eurasia allowed the French to exploit American fears of communism in order to prolong their colonial presence in Indochina, whereas the same priorities led Washington to pressure the Dutch increasingly to grant independence to the non-communist-led Indonesian Republicans. This French diplomatic victory in 1949-50 dealt Vietnamese non-communists a terrible blow. Bao Dai realized it immediately upon his return to Vietnam in April 1949, when the French refused to transfer to him the Palais Norodom in Saigon, the seat of the High Commissioner of Indochina and the center of French colonial power since 1863. Bao Dai knew that Pinon was using the Associated State of Vietnam, like the Cochinchinese Republic before it, as a weapon to hold on colonially. He did not take his life in protest as Nguyen Van Thin had done. Instead, the ex-emperor withdrew into his world and holed himself up in Dalat. He resisted the French passively and tried, when he could, to advance the ASV's interests. He placed a palm branch on the monument dedicated to the Vietnamese the French had executed during the Battle of Hanoi. He refused all colonial efforts to crown him again. He would rarely dress up in royal garb or tour the countryside to serve as the protectorate's cultural intermediary. His refusal to play his part as head of state drove the Indochina hands up the wall, as his immobility undermined the legitimacy and laid bare the poverty of the French Bao Dai solutions from Serot to Pignon once again. Sitting in Jean Cousseau's Dalat villa, Lucien Baudard later recalled Cousseau's furious words when the latter got off the phone with Bao Dai. "Tough. So Bao Dai thinks he's so smart? He wants to play what he calls his game? This will perhaps finish badly for us, but it will end even worse for him. Don't forget what I said." "He's a lardass," Cousseau repeatedly told me after having tried to prove unsuccessfully to Bao Dai for hours that the peasants in the Delta were awaiting him, that by appearing before them he would become again the son of heaven. But rather than turning the monarchy on the colonizer and the communists by leading a crusade for independence against the French, as Norodom Sihanouk and Mohammed V would do in Morocco in 1953 and 1955 respectively, Bao Dai intentionally let it die. In fact, the king of the Nguyen dynasty knew that the French had already killed it. But his French-bred passivity, and possibly French money, ensured that non-communist Vietnamese nationalists could never make the last Nguyen emperor take action against the colonizers or the communists, much less both. Bao Dai preferred inertia as resistance. It was not enough, though. It prevented him from building up any popular support worthy of notice and ensured that the monarchy would never be revived. Pignon's associated states of Indochina were, however, part of larger French efforts to preserve their international standing in the Atlantic Alliance. This took on particular importance from 1950 onward, when the crisis in Berlin in 1949, followed by the outbreak of the Korean War, sparked Western fears of a communist assault on both sides of Eurasia and accelerated Western efforts to reinforce the defense of Western Europe through the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, and the creation of a Western European army known as the European Defense Community. French leaders used the Indochina War as a way of demonstrating their commitment to the Atlantic Alliance and obtaining American aid to continue prosecuting the war as part of the global effort to contain Eurasian communism. For some scholars, France's blind commitment to the war in Indochina undermined its European ambitions. Others insist that the First Indochina War actually allowed the French to keep themselves at the great powers table and promote their ambitions in NATO and European integration and defense. By committing more troops to Indochina in 1951, one of France's strongest defenders of the Atlantic Alliance and the maintenance of the French Union, Georges Bidault, pointed out to his colleagues that our actions in Tonkin preserves us on the Rhine, since it preserves the Atlantic community. Recasting Communist Vietnam, Transnational State-Making and Modern War. Vietnamese communists had their own version of the Associated States of Indochina. Mirroring the colonial transformation of the Indochinese Federation into the Associated States of Indochina in 1948-50 was the communist decision to divide the Indochinese Communist Party along national, though equally, associated lines. In 1949, Vietnamese communists began preparations to create the Vietnamese Workers' Party, formally approved during the Second Party Congress held in 1951. They could have left it and the colonial model of Indochina there and focused on Vietnam. Instead, like their French opponents, they simultaneously approved the establishment of associated states, national fronts, and communist parties for Laos and Cambodia. The fact that there were hardly any non-Viet communists in Laos and Cambodia did not stop them. In 1950,